What was that?
It was the Bach A minor concerto, played by Itzhak Perlman with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. I know.
Great pronunciation, but the facts are a little
Who was
askew
that violinist?
There. Well, our guest, Pinchas Zukerman, violinist and conductor there, English Chamber Orchestra.
Oh, it's the English Chamber Orchestra.
Yeah, 15 years ago. Welcome to...
It was in 1897, I think. August 15th.
Yeah, scratched into birch bark. Yeah, that's the way they recorded back then. Well, welcome to the midday. Happy to have you here after playing your CDs for all these many years.
Oh, that's very nice to hear. Thank you for having me.
That piece that we started with is one of the pieces you'll be playing with the Madison Symphony Orchestra.
Right.
This weekend, mm-hmm. conducting, and
Friday, Saturday,
soloing.
And Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
It's amazing you have three
isn't it? Here. Yeah, they just, as I'm sure they told you, recently added that.
Yeah, last
third
night
concert.
I had this first rehearsal, the Overture, and that's a fantastic place. What a wonderful hall. How lucky you are all. Oh, it's fantastic. I remember coming here with St. Paul Chamber Orchestra in the old theater up at the university campus. You know, and I go back to 1966, would you believe it?
Yes.
I did education. But I was still in diapers, you know.
Yeah. Prodigy.
I came, there was a fellow here at the university and thought of outreach, new thing at that time, outreach program. I went to Baraboo and Waukesha. Oh. I was 17 years old and I went and stayed for a few days and played pool and hustled the guys. And then they all came to the concert. Never heard of Debussy before, you know, but... It all came. It was very nice.
Well, you know, that raises an interesting question. And you have been credited with occasionally you'll be walking down the street, you know, in your tails with your violin going to a concert. And some street person will say, well, you know, what kind of music do you play? And you say, well, you know, I don't play jazz and I don't play this, that, yeah. But I play classical stuff. And then you'll invite them to the concert. Does that
Absolutely.
Really happen?
Well, that last time, well, it happened a whole bunch of times. But this one you are alluding to, I think. Was in Vancouver, and I was in my tails. I was going to play Brahms concerto in the second half, and this guy looked like a homeless person with a bicycle, and he had his little nylon or whatever it was, little bag with him. And as we were crossing the street, the way he talked to me, it was really not very nice. So I said a couple of crude things, and he said, "Hey, man, I'm just trying to find out what you do." And I said, "Well, I play over there. You see that sign says Orpheum." He says, "Oh yeah, what are you playing?" I said, "Brahms." He said, "Brahms violin is my favorite piece." I said, "Okay, then come with me." And then, as a token of appreciation, he came backstage afterwards. He wanted to give me his lunch. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
He's just an artist that was, you know, was catching his last boat across, and it was really nice. Anyway,
So that's what outreach is.
Yeah, that's outreach to me.
Money.
Oh yeah, you bet. No outreach. Listen, we do. I must say, in the 8 years I've been now in Ottawa. That's in Canada. For anybody that doesn't know where Canada is, it's north of here. We have done some amazing, amazing things in education. I want you to know that last year, both in Canada and when we go on tour abroad, we played for 87,000 kids.
Wow.
Which
Whoa.
Means almost 200,000 parents. So mm-hmm. That's pretty, pretty amazing. And we are starting on Monday, actually. We're starting what I call a side-by-side, which is a eventually will become hopefully will become an orchestral institute for study where people that are in 19, 20 years old, depending on what situation they're in school, audition for the orchestra and come and work with us. So there's a kind of a bridge between school and the professional life because there is nothing like that. We have that in Europe. We have that in Berlin. We have it in Munich and so on, in Paris. But in North America, it's one of its kind now. And we're starting it on Monday. So I'm very, very proud of that.
Congratulations.
Yes,
and it's all done by the orchestra. Orchestra absolutely auditions everyone. I have nothing to do with it. I just instigate it, so to speak.
The catalyst.
Yeah, the sort of catalyst, yeah. It's kind of pretty good.
Well, why not the clarinet, though?
I couldn't breathe. I was 6 years old. Oh. I still can't breathe with the clarinet. My father played all those instruments, so yeah. I just grabbed it one morning and I started to play a little bit, but it wasn't really studying it. I just did it for fun. I did study the recorder, and the reason I studied the recorder is because to learn music, to read music. And then eventually a friend of my dad said, "Hey, why don't you give him a fiddle, you know?" Mm-hmm. And he never thought of it, actually. He just thought, okay. So I started playing on the violin. Because I had perfect pitch, he taught me how to tune. And it's very important. It's hard for a little kid to move the pegs sometimes. When you're 5 years old, those pegs get stuck, so they don't. But if you have perfect pitch, they really should do their own tuning, even if they can't quite move it, because it's your own instrument. It becomes yours. Nobody takes it away from you. It's like a tennis racket. You know, they go to sleep with a tennis racket.
Well, there's another great story about you. It's the only one I've heard of where a child performer impresses a potential teacher, and I guess this teacher had already sort of turned you down. But you were on the way out the door, and she said, well, why don't you just at least tune your violin? And she was so impressed with the way you tuned it.
That's right.
That you became a student.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That takes some doing to impress somebody just by tuning a violin?
Well, because, you know, when I can tell you in hindsight now, it is important for a teacher to not only see the child as and what they do, but their relationship to the instrument. And that relationship to the instrument is the thing that really makes a difference long term. There's no question about it. I watch that very carefully. I watch the whole physical connection that people have to their instruments, and they're so different. It's quite wonderful. But you know, you can tell by instinct, a lot by instinct, but of course by watching for over 30 years now, how people connect and how they tune, how they actually tune the instrument, will tell you quite a lot about their whole insight of music and how they feel about it. Kind of interesting. It's hard to verbalize, but I can show you, if you came with me for a few auditions, you would be amazed. And it's so telling, so telling. The character of the person comes out immediately. Because, you know, there are people that feel that an instrument is a tool to make money, to make a living. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I have never felt that. See, I've never been... I can't even imagine that the violin is a tool I make money. What? it's like a carpenter's blah blah or a shoemaker's blah blah instrument. It's not. It's a voice of society. It's the voice of the soul of society. And that is there for eternity.
So do you become sort of unaware of the violin as you play?
Oh, I'm aware of it, of course. You change the strings, you clean it, you keep it. I'm not trying to be funny, but of course I'm aware of it, but it's in the soul searching of what it is. When I play a note, I don't play a note because it's work. I play a note because that's what the composer, first of all, intended, at least my idea of what the composer wanted, a boing, and it becomes an integral aspect of your whole being, your whole being. So I don't hear sounds. I hear the totality of somebody's expression. And it can be the composer or the player or whatever that may be.
Back to outreach for a minute. I can feel your passion and your commitment to, you know, passing this great art on to young people. Does that come from the wonderful mentors that you had when you were a youngster?
Sure. Of course. Yeah. I was given the best possible education one can have. Not only because of their knowledge, but as people. To be around not only Galamian and Feher, and all, but to be around people like Isaac Stern, you know, where on one moment he's on the phone with Carnegie Hall, the next thing he's talking about Bach, you know. That's an education that I'm very fortunate to have been able to be there, and then to become his friend, his colleague, his confidant to some extent. I do that now with my kids, same thing. I don't ask him for anything. I just want him to be happy with what they do. Music is a wonderful friend. And if you're capable of playing it properly, if you have a physical dexterity that's given to you by some extraordinary natural existence out there, an energy, your responsibility is to make sure that you go to the highest possible form of understanding of that, because that then brings out the music. And so I try to explain the emotion and the intellect at the same time, which is what it is. It's two sides of our brain. I've been lucky enough to see both, and I continue doing it every day. And it absolutely translates to everything I do, all decision making. It's not done on a run. It's done with great care and a tremendous amount of knowledge. And if I don't know something, I'll ask, because that keeps you vulnerable, and it should be. The vulnerability is the aspect we lose as we get older for some silly reason. I'm not sure why. I guess people believe their critics or the newspapers.
Instant vulnerability there. Yes, you've been quoted as saying that you need that edge, I guess, of imperfection when you go into a performance, that you're rarely satisfied with the result of a performance.
Well, you can be satisfied. There's nothing wrong with feeling satisfied about a phrase you played and you played it well. But how do you play it tomorrow? How do we do this tomorrow and the next day? It's been, and I'm raising my hand here, this left hand is 50 years of doing this. And I still feel good about opening up the violin case. That zipper is still okay. So every day. And if you don't, oh, you're dead in the water. If you don't do it for 2 days, you're finished. You just psychologically, you can't. There's no way to recover. You have to maintain that steady work. And even if it's 15 or 20 minutes of scales, just do it. Like they do at Nike, just do it.
You're one of the few people who plays both violin and viola. I assume mostly violin, but...
Depends. Next week I'm playing viola.
Yes?
I'm playing Bartok concerto with my orchestra, yeah. Uh-huh. With a great conductor, by the way. A young fellow called Dudamel. Gustavo Dudamel. He comes from Caracas, from Venezuela. This guy is phenomenal. That's really a great, great, great... You will be amazed when you see him and when you hear of him, if you haven't heard of him already. He's quite phenomenal.
But is there some kind of adjustment that you make from one instrument to the other?
Yeah. I get up earlier because it's heavier. No, not really. No. There's no... It's very similar. It's a very similar way of approach. You learn to... It's really the right hand goes out a little bit further. For me, it's a very natural extension of my left hand. I don't have to squeeze very hard on the tip of the fingers. So it plays more naturally. I don't really warm up so much on the viola. I warm the instrument up rather than my hand. I just love it. It's just, it feels good when I play the viola. From day one, it felt so natural to play it.
You worked when you were young with Eugene Stoman?
Well, I lived in his room.
Where do we go from there?
With his parents in his room. Eugene, I saw a lot. I worked a little bit. Here and there, he would come over and practice sometimes on his piano. And he said, come on, play with me. I said, what am I going to play? He said, it's a spring sonata. I said, okay. So we start playing, and then he start talking to me about the music. And sometimes he would accompany me in Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, for example, which was wonderful. Wonderful, great pianist accompanying Tchaikovsky Concerto. And he would say, well, what's that about, that phrase? And I go, I don't know. It goes from here to there, and then it goes from here to there. And, come on, you can do it better than this. And so, yeah, of course. But I knew him very well, of course, because I went to dinner with him a lot. He took me out with his parents. And, of course, when the trio started to play a lot, I turned pages for him. He had a thing about turning pages, page turners. So, actually, I fell a little bit asleep at one of the concerts. Not exactly asleep.
And lost your place,
right? I was at rehearsals. You know, imagine Lenny Rose, Isaac Stern, and him playing. And I was there at rehearsal, and they're arguing and fighting and stuff. And Isaac was watching the Yankee game at the same time on the TV. That was fantastic, you know? Yeah, it's wonderful. They were amazing people. Loved life more than anything.
Do you think there's less fighting about performance like that now than there was then?
Nah, it's not fighting. It's just disgusting. You know, Lenny would say something, Isaac, come on, play that over here, you know, on this part of the bone. He said, no, I don't want to play it. I'll play it over here. He said, no, it's better here. I tell you, Isaac, it's better here. So, you know, he would play a little bit, and Isaac said, you really like it that way? Let's try the other way, you know. So they... It's that kind of magic that if you are confronted and see it at an early age, it never leaves you. Isaac said to me always, he said, Pinky, be a sponge. I said, how do I become a sponge? He said, you know what I'm talking about. He said, be a sponge. I said, okay. You know, so I would go, on a regular basis, not every day, but I would end up at maybe two or three concerts a night sometimes.
Wow.
In New York between a Marilyn Horne recital to a Guarneri Quartet something or other, or the New York Philharmonic. I snuck in all the time to hear rehearsals and concerts. And so it was an incredible education. Plus, I played pool all night. So
that helped. Did that help? What did playing pool do for you?
Well, if I could earn a couple of bucks, I could have breakfast.
Well, I'm wondering, with all of this energy, how did you make yourself sit down and practice?
I didn't.
Oh.
That was a problem.
Oh, I see.
But I got smart. After about 16, I said, okay, that's enough of this. And I started to really work very seriously.
And who you grew up with quite a cohort of musicians coming up at that time. Who were some of the people, your colleagues?
Oh, everybody.
Everybody?
Just about everybody. It was amazing. Amazing.
And did you play the Ed Sullivan Show when you were 12, or was that...
No, I saw that.
I thought they were talking about It's Like Pearl.
Actually, Ed Sullivan was responsible for his coming to this country in conjunction with the American Zirkusha Foundation, which people don't realize, but Itzik and I played for Ed when he was in I call him, I didn't even know the guy.
He was in Israel, wasn't he?
He came to Israel. He would go around searching for talent. And Itzik played, he was 13, I was 10, something like that. And he took him because he was obviously older and needed the help, a lot of the help. And he came with his mom. I followed about 2 years later or so, 2.5 years later. I was 13 when I left. He was a little older. So it was, we've become, have been and be at that time already we were still young kids, but we've remained friends and family and kids, and they all know each other and grandchildren and blah 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 blah. It's great.
Well, we thought maybe we would go back to 1986 or so. I'm not sure quite when this was recorded, but it's one of the earliest CDs we have of your recordings. It's the Ravel piece in the form of a habanera. This is with Mark Nykrug?
Yes, your longtime accompanist. Well, our guest today, Pinchas Zukerman and Mark Nykrug, with the piece in the form of an habanera by Ravel 20 years ago or so. What did you think of that? Did you like that?
I didn't. Well, I kind of, a little bit. I didn't really. We were talking. So.
Giving away our secrets.
Trade secrets there.
We were talking earlier, too, about public radio.
Yes.
And how
well, I was very much involved with public radio when I was in St. Paul with Bill Kling and company.
Oh, yes.
And we did some amazing things. Actually, for a couple of years, we were right after Garrison Keillor. He was at 6 to 8, and at 8 o'clock, we went out live. And the first year, we got, maybe 120-some stations, and then it just jumped to 200-some the next year. So then sometimes we would actually connect. I went on Garrison's show, and then I would run down to play, and so it was a fantastic thing. It was really great, incredible. But music has suffered a little bit in this country now on the waves, the airwaves, and it's a whole change that's taking place. Some of it will be very, very good, I think, because we will reach a lot more people through the computer. The computer itself is the way to go. It's no longer just for email it's for everything. And I think once we have the files on the computer large enough for sound and music and picture, sound and picture to go simultaneously. The sound is still a problem. It requires so much bandwidth, for the computer particularly. But I've been doing this stuff for so many years now, teaching, for example, video conferencing. It's gone, and interesting enough, in Canada, we are actually a little bit ahead of the States in maturity, so to speak. You have internet too here. We're already at what you would call here Internet 4. It's kind of amazing. And we are connected to the whole country. Every high school is connected to each other. So the information is there available for everyone to have.
Oh, that's spectacular.
Yeah. Do you feel that music education in the schools is also suffering?
Terribly. But we'll be able to connect more and more. We go to very outlandish places now. First Nation people, for example. We reach up in Nunavut. It's way up there in the north. Just to sound we care. And a couple of them will say, well, I've got this violin here. I said, where'd you get that? Well, somebody made it. They don't know how to make it. We don't have any strings. We don't have this. We don't have that. So we get them strings, we get them going on this stuff. And so I said, how about a recorder? And they said, oh, yeah, we'd love some recorders. So we've been sending out, we've sent over 3,000 recorders around the country. So it's a great program. Yamaha has helped us, and we've done so much. Really, this outreach is extraordinary, and it's just continuing. It's wonderful, just wonderful. We're putting seeds everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it will grow into huge gardens. There's no question about it.
Well, yeah, there's no question that to reach young people is obviously the future of anything, and certainly true of classical music.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And they're so open to it, except I know Vicky and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday. You were often surprised by the things that younger audience like in classical music. I mean, they certainly tend to skew toward more contemporary pieces, not entirely, and there's also some evidence that they like early music because it's so rhythmic and kind of unpredictable, but you never know.
The question is, the people are putting it on, the presenters, of what's the bottom line here? And that's a problem. We're always going to lose money because it's called nonprofit. The arts are nonprofit. Why do we have a museum? That's also nonprofit. Why do we have a ballet company? Why do we have actually a hospital that loses a fortune? Well, a hospital raises an enormous amount of money every year. They have to. For supplies, for lab work, for all kinds of things, never mind salaries. But it's obvious, because if you don't have a hospital to take care of you, you're going to die. Well, you know what? If you don't have the arts, you're going to die. So it's a question of proportion. We have to find ways in the future, over the next 20 to 30 years, a way of communicating better together and share information, share data, subsequently form some kind of a committee or some sort of a body that will knock on 1600 Pennsylvania and say, government in this country, you've got to help us. You've got to help us. It's not enough just to help us here, there, and there. The arts are most important. And that's true in the Orient. If you just look at the Orient, the whole Asian population.
Burgeoning.
Absolutely. Without the arts, they would not be where they are in the business. And they're taking over the world. We're lagging way behind now. So we better face up to it in Washington.
We're a little behind with this quiz question, too. Have we even mentioned the specifics of the concerts
we
the
will,
next three
right now.
Days?
How about that? Madison Symphony Orchestra with Pinchas Zukerman conducting and soloing in the Bach Violin Concerto in A minor, a wonderful piece we heard at the beginning of the midday. Also, Der Freischütz Overture by Weber and the Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4.
The biggie.
The big one. The wonderful.
Fate, one of those fate symphonies.
Wonderful concert. Mm-hmm. And three concerts this weekend, Friday night, 7:30, Saturday night at 8, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30 in that wonderful Overture Hall in Madison. And you'll find more information at the website, madisonsymphony.org.